Hey freaks, welcome to Vegan Freak Radio for the week of January 30th, 2007. This week on Vegan Freak Radio, we are part one of our follow-up interview with Gary Francione. On the show, Gary Francione answers your questions, listener questions, and we also get talking about veganism and the animal rights movement.
The movement isn't forcing them to think about veganism, because the movement is saying you can be a moral person by continuing to eat animal products, as long as you do so conscientiously and you cut out some of them, you can be a moral person in that way. And I mean, think about that as a matter of psychology. If you tell people you can be moral by being something less than a vegan, what's going to happen? People will not be vegan.
We also discuss abolitionism, welfareism, and the future of animal activism.
What animal welfare does is simply make animal exploitation more efficient. And so you end up with animal advocates being advisors to the meat industry saying, hey guys, you can make greater profits if you treat your animals a little bit nicer. Certainly, as I've always said, I'm always in favor of less suffering and not more. But I think it's a sad comment that the animal movement has been reduced to being economic advisors for the meat industry.
All of this, plus answers to most of your questions on things ranging from abortion to religion to transplants to burnout on Vegan Freak Radio. It is our great pleasure to have Professor Gary Francione back on the show. Gary Francione is a professor in the School of Law at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And Professor Francione was on the show back in November or December, and the response we got from that show was one of the greatest responses we have ever had. Many of you had some objections to things he said, some of you agreed, many of you had questions. And so Professor Francione has very graciously agreed to come back for a second run on Vegan Freak Radio to answer your questions. So this show is about answering all the questions we've received from people out there, and we're very much looking forward to it. Thank you for coming on to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bob and Jenna. It's always a pleasure, and I got a tremendously positive response from my last appearance on your show, and so I'm looking forward to this one.
Excellent. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this class you're teaching with Anna Charlton about animal rights and human rights?
Well, you know, this class sort of, let me explain the evolution of our teaching efforts. I started teaching animal rights theory in 85 when I was at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was teaching jurisprudence, and I introduced animal rights to that then. And then in 1989, I moved to Rutgers, and in 1990 with Anna Charlton, we started the Rutgers Animal Rights Clinic, which was the first thing of its kind in the country, where students were getting 6 academic credits for learning animal rights theory in a seminar that we had every week, but also working with us on cases involving rights, the rights of students to not use animals in the classroom, or the rights of prisoners to get vegan food, and other sorts of cases that we did, the rights of people to protest and to not be charged huge amounts of money for licenses by the police, etc. And so we closed the clinic in 2000, largely because the animal rights movement in the United States, at least, had become so relentlessly welfarist. We were finding it harder and harder to find interesting, you know, cases that interested us that were consistent with the abolitionist philosophy. So we switched our efforts to focusing exclusively on our classroom teaching and continuation of our course in animal rights. And last year we developed a new course called Animal Rights and Human Rights, where we talk about the relationship between various forms of discrimination against humans and discrimination against non-humans, and what these things share in common. So we discuss, we have a sort of a general theoretical introduction where we introduce the students to different types of moral theory. And then we talk about things like civil rights and women's rights and homophobia and abortion and the war on terror and things like that. And then we relate this all to how we commodify, objectify, and discriminate against non-humans. And this semester, we've got 65 students in that class,
Wonderful.
Which is a remarkable enrollment. And so we're very happy, and they're just terrific students. I have to say that we're 2 weeks into the semester, and I have to say that the students are just marvelous, and they're really engaged. It's very clear to me that that young people, and I hate to sound like my father here, but that young people are, I think, reawakening to moral issues. I think we're coming out of a period, at least I want to hope that we are, so perhaps this is wishful thinking on my part, but I want to hope that we are coming out of a period of moral nihilism and sort of a lack of concern about moral issues, and I think students are getting more and more interested interested in moral issues. And when I see the level of engagement I'm getting from the students in my class, it's clear to me that there seems to be a reawakening and a reemergence of interest in these issues. And so I'm really excited about it. We're having a very, very good time with the students, and I'm looking forward to tomorrow. I teach tomorrow, and actually, I am looking forward to it. And the two of you are relatively young academics. I have to tell you, I'm now in my 23rd year of teaching.
Wow. Oh,
man. And it's really something to say, I can't wait until I get to class tomorrow. After 23 years, you don't often feel that way. And I'm really excited about what's going on in that class. We're having lots of fun.
That's cool. That's because I've just spent the week, I'm working on a book right now, and I just spent the week writing about these kinds of shared systems of oppression and how they function structurally within the economy and within society. I'm very happy to hear that students are coming around to that, because when I introduced that notion in one of my classes, there was so much resistance to it. It was absurd.
Well, it's interesting. One of the problems with the modern animal rights movement is that it is... It's reluctant to want to focus on other political issues.
Absolutely.
In an effort to make sure that its donor base is as broad as possible, and so as not to offend anybody, the modern animal rights movement stays away from political issues. But as I've been saying for 20 years now, you can't stay away from political issues. These things are all interrelated.
Absolutely.
And you can't... You can't say that the issue of animal oppression can be looked at in any sensible way apart from its connection to the oppression of other marginalized groups in the society. You simply can't do that. But that's what I remember some years ago I was invited to speak. There used to be, I don't know whether there still is, but there used to be an event every year called the Summit, I think it was called the Summit for the Animals. It's where the leaders, I hate that word, but where the leaders of the animal rights movement gathered to discuss their common issues and common problems, whatever.
Right.
And I was invited one year to come and talk about the relationship of speciesism to sexism, racism, and homophobia. And I showed up at this event, which, as I recall, was being held in Boston, and I gave my talk about how speciesism, sexism, homophobia, racism were all interrelated, and I had a room full of blank faces looking at me saying, look, we don't really want to get into these issues at all. Our issue is the animal issue, and I remember specifically Cleveland Amory, who is now passed from... he has passed this mortal coil. And Cleveland said, we don't have a position on sexism any more than we have a position on the rights of Palestinians. And I said, no, I disagree. I think we have a position on the rights of women. I also think we have a position on the rights of Palestinians.
That's right.
And that is, they all have rights. None of them should be commodified.
That's right.
And that as long as we're commodifying humans, in any sense, any humans, we're going to have a problem seeing the problem with commodifying non-humans. It really was an interesting event because it was very clear to me that nobody really wanted to have that sort of discussion. And I think that in large part they thought that, well, what I was advocating was that we had to go to everybody else's rallies or whatever. And I was saying, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that what our position, what our baseline position ought to be, is that we're opposed to discrimination against human animals for any reason whatsoever. And therefore, we are opposed to sexism, racism, homophobia, the genocide of the Palestinians, whatever it is. We are opposed to those things. Put it this way, it was a hard sell.
I can imagine.
So I think that is, but that's a consequence of the fact that the animal rights movement is really not a political and social movement. It's a business.
Yep.
Any sort of discussion of anything serious is an opportunity cost no one wants to incur, because it runs the risk of alienating a potential donor out there, and nobody wants to do that. So, you know, the movement tries to be all things to all people so as to motivate, as to maximize the donor base, and ends up being nothing to anyone because its positions are contentless.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I don't want to get too far into this, but I think that what the movement suffers from is a fetish on animal suffering and kind of a lack of concern for any other kind of suffering. From my perspective, it's that there is suffering, and that suffering should be examined across the entire spectrum. But I don't want to go...
I agree with you. I mean, years ago, when I was involved with... many people may not know this, but through the 80s and into the early 90s, I was very, very much involved with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I did an enormous amount of legal work or legal projects with them. And one of the reasons why I ended up parting company with PETA was when they started the I'd Rather Go Naked Than Wear Fur campaign, which I thought was sexist. I blogged on that, the issue of PETA sexism, last week. I think it's only gotten worse, but, you know, in 1990 it wasn't great. And when that started, I remember having discussions with people at PETA and being told, well, you know, sexism isn't our issue. And I said, no, I'm sorry, but, you know, if speciesism is wrong because it is like racism, sexism, and homophobia and other forms of discrimination, that logically implies that we think that racism, sexism, homophobia, and other forms of discrimination are wrong.
Absolutely.
And so this notion that we fetishize animal suffering to the exclusion of everything else is not only morally problematic, but it's logically inconsistent with the idea that sexism, that speciesism is bad because it is like these other forms of discrimination.
Right on.
Indeed.
You just talked about your website.
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe you could tell our listeners out there a little bit about it as well.
Well, you know, for those folks who don't know, we have a website at www.animal-law.org, which is the URL of the website that we used to have when we had the Animal Rights Clinic, which we closed, as I mentioned before, in 2000. And there is also a blog at http://garyfrancione.blogspot.com, which you can access from the main website page. On our main website page, we have four movies, or whatever you want to call them. Basically, The Theory of Animal Rights, The Problem of Animals as Property, Animal Rights versus Animal Welfare, and Animal Law. And viewers can watch those as flash presentations, and then they can go to the blog for discussion of further topics. But we launched that in early December. Actually, it was after I was on your show the first time, and I am amazed at the response that we are getting. We're getting about 700 visitors a day from all over the world. I'm getting so many emails, I simply cannot keep up with them. They're very useful to me, and I'm encouraging people to write to me because I am choosing my topics for my blog based on the sorts of responses, the sorts of emails I'm getting. But the response is remarkable, and it's so great that we now are doing translations into French, Spanish, Portuguese, and German.
Wonderful.
And I'm very, very excited about it, and I am real. I'm not a techno sort of guy, Bob and Jenna. I am what one might call a Luddite, and I'm being dragged, kicking and screaming, into the internet age. It's clear that this is, as I mentioned, I think the last time I was with you, I think that the internet is important because it's It's allowing us to communicate with each other. We don't have to communicate through the organized groups anymore, through the corporate welfare organizations anymore. We can now communicate through this thing called the internet, which lowers the opportunity cost of communication and make it possible for us to talk to each other in a way that we weren't not really able to do so before. I didn't even understand the extent to which that is possible now until we launched this website, and I'm getting a lot of responses from all over, from Western Europe, from Asia, from India, from all over the place, from Mexico, from all over the place, from people who are saying, look, you know, I agree with you. The way we're conceptualizing the problem is wrong. These organizations are all doing this the wrong way, and we really do need to form an international grassroots approach to this that is abolitionist and that represents a coherent opposition to all forms of discrimination and that sees veganism as the baseline of the abolitionist movement with respect to the animal issue. So I'm very, very excited, and I had no idea that it was going to be popular as it's as it is, and that people were going to respond to it as enthusiastically as they have. But it's exciting, but it's also a lot of work, and yes. But you have a site, so you know this.
Yes,
and,
we do.
this is new to me, and so it's very exciting, and I'm really looking forward to how it's going to expand. And as I say, we're doing these translations, and I'm very, very excited about that.
That's wonderful. And besides the teaching and the website, you also have a new book coming out from Columbia University Press.
I do. It's called The Personhood of Animals, and it is going to be out, I hope, late spring, early summer. I'm just about to send the manuscript off to Columbia, so if my editor at Columbia is listening, I'm sorry it's late. I'm sorry. I apologize. I've been working hard on it, but it's almost done, and it's a set of essays some of which are things that I published before, some of which are new essays, but focusing on the concept of the personhood of non-human animals and the notion that as long as an animal is sentient, by which I mean is subjectively aware, that animal has a right not to be treated as property. I'm hoping to follow this book up with another book in which I am going to be debating with a defender of animal welfare from Britain, in which we're going to have a debate about animal rights versus animal welfare. But this book is going off, I hope, next week, and then I will start work on the next book, which is going to be called, tentatively, Animal Rights versus Animal Welfare. Animal welfare, the debate. So that will be, I think, an exciting project.
Well, congratulations on finishing that up. I'm very much looking forward to reading that.
Thank you.
So maybe what we should do now is move into some of these questions. We have a bunch of questions from listeners out there, and I just think we should just run right at them head on. Is that all right with you?
Yeah, you know, I just want to say, you put out a request for questions, and from your freaks. Is that what you call your people who are?
Yeah.
Is that the right noun for the people who are adherents or who are subscribers to your site? And I have to say, I am very impressed by the quality of the questions I've gotten. They are really excellent questions. Excellent questions.
We have smart listeners.
Well, I don't doubt that. I mean, but I mean, these are high quality questions.
Glad to hear that. So maybe, Jenna, you want to start?
Sure. The first one we got in several different forms from a couple different people, and it has to do with the very end of our show. You'd called back last time to talk about your views on violence to other humans and to property. So some people, I think, wanted you to expand upon that a little bit. So we have a question from Texas Cat Chick who asks, in the last podcast, when Gary called back at the end of the show to emphasize the idea that the AR abolition movement should be considered part of the peace movement, I wondered if he thought that open rescues were a peaceful and effective tool. And then someone continued on, Mango continued on to say, to think about what is in an abolitionist online article, what she'd like to know how Gary would evaluate whether direct actions further hinder or further the cause. And so could you talk about that?
Well, yeah, sure. And actually, there were, you know, let me say, first of all, there were some people who had questions. They used the expression direct action. Let me just clarify something. For many years, I have been saying that veganism is direct action. And so I want to make clear, when I talk about direct action, I include veganism in that. So let's focus on what I'd like to focus on right now is the idea of violence to humans and to property. I have a serious problem with that for a number of reasons. First of all, I think it's morally problematic. The history of humankind is an endless cycle of violence and violent reaction, and more violence and then more violent reactions. What I see this movement as is a reaction to all that in saying, no, let's put an end to all of that. I think there's something morally problematic with violence. I believe very, very strongly in nonviolence. Very, very strongly in nonviolence. And I don't think we're going to win by yet another justification for violent action. I am horrified when I hear the sorts of things that Jerry Vlasic says or Rod Coronado says. I find that absolutely horrifying. I don't think that's the solution to the problem. I think that's part of the problem. Really, when we look at it, I think we have to see that what we're objecting to is patriarchy and violence, and we're not going to solve that with more machismo and more patriarchal violence. I don't think that's going to work. The notion that, well, what about, you know, a number of people have sent me emails saying, yeah, but what if we could blow up a research facility and not injure anybody? That's silly. That's a silly hypothetical. You cannot engage in that sort of activity without presenting a risk to humans and to non-humans. I mean, it's a completely unrealistic hypothetical, okay? So, I mean, I don't find that interesting to sort of even talk about, well, what if we could blow up a building and not hurt any humans and not hurt any non-humans? The answer is no, sorry, folks. That's an impossibility.
Well, what about, for example, actually, one of the people who was asking the question quoted something from an article in the Abolitionist Online that was saying, they're talking about ALF raids, and it says, internationally, the ALF have made great strides in making these forms of exploitation as unprofitable as possible. While simultaneously exposing the horrors of their functioning to the general public through footage captured during raids. I mean, those examples, right, they're not blowing up a building.
Well, no, but I mean, first of all, I'd like to know what his proof is for the position that ALF activities are imposing opportunity costs that are resulting in industry changing its decision making. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, that's absolutely wrong. I don't think that that's true true at all. And so, I mean, I disagree with that. I mean, I also think that in addition to the moral problems, Bob and Jenna, I think that there are some strategic problems here in terms of, I think that this way of doing things is strategically stupid. I mean, think about it. These actions have only a meaning insofar as there's a cultural context that gives them meaning. There isn't. We live in a culture in which 99.999999% of the people out there eat animals and animal products. And the best justification we have for doing that is they taste good, i.e. we don't have a justification for doing that. People impose horrible pain, suffering, and death on zillions of animals every year for no good reason. Now, many of the activities, I mean, let's just take an example of direct action understood as violence to humans and property, not as veganism, against people who are involved in research. How are people going to understand that? We live in a society in which people think it's all right to impose suffering and death on animals because it tastes good. When you have people who are doing research with animals and they say, this research is resulting in benefits for humans. Now, I think that's nonsense, but I mean, that's what most people believe. Does anybody really think that we are going to be communicating with members of the public by saying, well, we're trying to stop biomedical research. Most people think it's all right to kill animals for no reason whatsoever. They certainly think it's okay to do it when there are benefits, when there are really what they perceive are important benefits. So, I mean, it seems to me that there is no context for these activities to have any meaning whatsoever. I mean, I think it's strategically a very, very unsound thing to do because, I mean, in addition to being morally problematic, I think it's strategically problematic in that I don't really think it's doing anything except making people convincing people that the movement really is crazy, that there really is sort of a disconnect between us and reality. And I'd like to say I received a lot of emails from people who are very concerned about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Well, people, let me tell you something. When you've got people like Jerry Vlasic out there saying it's all right to kill people and people like Rod Coronado saying it's all right to blow buildings up, I mean, we're dealing with an age of government overreach. We've got a government that is happy to be involved in overreaching and doing all sorts of things to affect our civil liberties. And you've got a population that's paranoid about violence that they think is terrorism. So when you got people like Jerry Vlasic, you know, saying on 60 Minutes it's okay to kill people, and people like Rod Coronado giving seminars about how to blow buildings up, I mean, you have handed them the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And I think, I mean, the idea that anybody thinks that is a sensible thing to do is just incredible to me. Fourth, I don't think that these sorts of activities accomplish anything. I mean you shut down one lab, the work gets transferred to another lab. I mean, if you shut down Huntington, you know, the Huntington laboratories, so what? I mean, does anybody think that's going to really stop any sort of animal? It's not going to stop anything. That activity is going to be transferred to another laboratory someplace else. I mean, you take an animal out of one place, the animal gets replaced immediately. I mean, it's not clear to me what anybody thinks that this is doing. I mean, in addition to situations which involve violence to humans, or violence to violence that threatens humans or non-humans, I'm not sure what anybody thinks this is doing. When you are releasing 2,000 mink, as happened some years ago, I mean, first of all, what's going to happen to those animals? I mean, you know, and what's going to happen to the environment in which those animals are released? I mean, is anybody doing any favor for those animals? I'm not sure. I mean, you know, it's an unclear question in my mind. But I mean, the bottom line is, I think the most important form of direct action is veganism. And I want to go back to the point that I always go back to. We've got limited time, we've got limited resources. We have got to make a decision about how best to use our time and our resources. And there is no doubt in my mind that our becoming vegans and our educating others about veganism is a much better use of our time, and encouraging nonviolence and educating people about nonviolence and veganism is a much better use of our time. I have a very, very serious problem with this notion that violence is either morally acceptable or strategically wise. I received an email from someone who said that there are ALF people who are not vegans. They're vegetarians, but they're not vegans. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I guess they eat some animal product, but they're not vegans. And they think that it's better to be an ALF person who's a vegetarian than to be a vegan. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means and how that makes sense. So let me see if I can get this clear. We're going to go and we're going to liberate animals, and then we'll go celebrate and eat cheese pizzas and ice cream and celebrate by eating animals that have been tortured in other ways. I mean, none of this makes any sense to me. And it seems to me that really at this point in time, reasonable minds cannot differ. There's going to be no progress until we build an abolitionist movement. There can be no abolitionist movement without there being a strong, clear, coherent vegan movement. And this idea that it's all right to engage in any sort of violence, or against humans, or violence which threatens humans or non-humans, simply does not make any sense to me, both on a moral ground and on a strategic ground.
Wow.
Yeah. It seems to me that, like, veganism really best gets at the root cause of it. Like, if you have heart disease, you know, you can take a pill, and it might get rid of a few of your symptoms, but the best thing to do is to eat better and to take better care of yourself and get at the root cause of that heart disease. It seems to me veganism is like doing that the best.
Maybe we should move on to another question here. This one came from James, and James wants to know what you think of the GRASP campaign, which is the Great Ape Standing and Personhood campaign of Friends and Animals in Lee Hall.
Okay. Well, I guess the way I understood that question, it refers to the fact that Friends of Animals has embraced this position that we ought to promote the personhood of non-human great apes, and I assume, although I don't know, that the reason why they're getting on board with this is because Lee Hall, who works for them, is the founder of this organization, GRASP, which stands for Great Ape Standing in Personhood. The basic idea is that personhood should in some way be linked to human-like cognitive characteristics. It's the position that animals who are more like us matter more than those who are less like us. This is also the position of the Great Ape Project. Look, I don't care what you call it. You can call it GAP. You can call it GRASP. You can call it Project R&R, which is what the New England Anti-Vivisection Society calls its campaign for chimpanzees. I don't agree with that approach. I think that the only similarity, the only characteristic that matters is sentience or subjective awareness. If a non-human is sentient, then it is my view that that non-human has the right not to be treated as a human resource. I mean, I please don't misunderstand me. I certainly don't think that we should be exploiting non-human great apes, but I don't think we should be exploiting any sentient non-humans, and I think it's dangerous to single out a particular species and say that they are entitled to special treatment because they are more like us than other animals. It's like saying that we're against slavery, but we're going to start by liberating light-skinned blacks or those who have no more than an eighth or a quarter African blood or something. I mean, I don't agree with that. I think that GAP, GRASP, or whatever you want to call it, I think that position is speciesist. I think it's hierarchical, and it can't help but further enforce the view that humans it can't help but reinforce the view that the line is between humans and animals like humans and all other humans. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is the non-human great apes form a very, very small percentage of the number of animals that we're exploiting. So what worries me is that what we're doing is we're establishing a new hierarchy, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to move some group of animals over to the protected side, but it's going to leave the vast number of other animals unprotected. Now, I do want to say I was one of the original contributors to GAP. But even, you know, in which was a book that the Great Ape Project came out in 1993. It was a book by Peter Singer and Paola Cavallari, and I had an essay in that book. But even in 1993, I argued that sentience was the only characteristic that was necessary for membership in the moral community. No other characteristics were required. I drew a line in my essay in 1993. I said, "Well, you know, sentience is all that's necessary. However, the fact that the great apes have sentience, plus they've got all these other characteristics, that's really sufficient for membership in the moral community." But in the years that followed, you know, I came to see that you really can't make a distinction here. To say that characteristic X is necessary, but characteristic XYZ is sufficient, is basically a position which in a speciesist society is going to result in X, Y, and Z being necessary for full membership in the moral community and equality. And actually, I have to say, and I've said this in writing, and I'll say it again now on your show, I regret my participation in GAP. It was a mistake on my part. I mean, even though I said in 1993 sentience was all that was necessary, what I didn't realize in 1993 was that by saying that the characteristics, the cognitive characteristics of the great apes were sufficient for personhood, even though they weren't necessary for personhood, was in essence a position that really couldn't be any. It was not a good distinction. I mean, it was a logical distinction, and it's a logically defensible distinction. But in terms of the way that distinction is interpreted in a species of society, it's going to result in reinforcing the idea that characteristics X, Y, and Z, namely characteristics beyond sentience, are going to be required for moral personhood. So I disagree completely with the gap-grasp approach. By 1999, when I wrote Introduction to Animal Rights, I came out very strongly against the whole sort of gap approach, and I've been writing about it ever since. I mean, I have articles in New Scientist, I have an article in the Journal of Animal Law and Ethics, and I have an essay coming out in Le Monde Diplomatique in next month, actually, in which I talk about the Spanish effort. There's an effort in Spain right now to try to get personhood for the great apes. And what I'm arguing is, you know, like, why are we focusing on the great apes? I mean, we're worried about the personhood of the great apes while we're sitting there eating our steaks and our fish and whatnot, and that there's something fundamentally wrong with that. I have to say, I looked at Lee Hall's essay on the web about why GRASP is not hierarchical. And this is a quote. She says, GRASP is based not on hierarchy, that is where we diverge from the Great Ape Project, but on the reality that people already view other ape communities as clearly self-aware and members of cultures, end quote. In other words, I guess what she's saying is GRASP is based on the fact that people already see apes as like us and look at the situation hierarchically, so we ought to look at it hierarchically, and which makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. And I also note on that website that I read that GRASP is supporting the campaign for ape personhood in Spain, which is explicitly based on the fact that apes have human-like characteristics. So it's hard for me to understand in what way GRASP and GAP differ. And the bottom line is they don't. I did want to say a couple of people in direct response to that GRASP position have asked me. There seems to be some view that. Or some belief that Lee Hall teaches animal rights with me at Rutgers. That is absolutely false. Anna and I had Lee some years back as a lecturer in our course, and we decided to discontinue her in part because we didn't think she really understood rights theory, and this whole grass business is a good example of that concern. So no, I don't agree with what Friends of Animals is doing here, and I certainly don't agree with the analysis that grass is not hierarchical. I think that these efforts to distinguish some animal, you know, this whole some animals are better than other animals approach is really no different to me than saying that, you know, after emancipation, there were still rules about, you know, if you had certain levels of African blood, you couldn't live in certain neighborhoods. I mean, I think it's the same sort of thing. You know, that emancipation is emancipation. The idea that emancipation starts with light-skinned blacks is crazy.
Definitely. Let's see. Our next question comes from several people.
A whole bunch of people.
on our forums and through email. And they wanted to know what your views are on abortion.
Boy, I get asked that all the time. Well, you know, I've written about this both in Introduction to Animal Rights and in an article that I wrote. I think the book was called Women and Animals. It was published by Duke University some years ago. I think that's the title. Let me say I'm a strong advocate for choice, and a lot of people have problems with that, and let me try to explain it. Let's talk first about sentience. As far as I'm concerned, if a being is not sentient, then that being doesn't have any interests at all, and I don't really think that being can be a morally significant being. Whether fetuses are ever sentient in the gestation process is a matter that's open to debate. I mean, fetuses certainly react to things, but so do plants, and I don't think plants have subjective awareness. I mean, I don't know whether fetuses are sentient. I certainly don't think that, apart from the Christian right, anybody believes that fetuses in the early part of gestation, in the first trimester and into the second trimester, that they're sentient. And as far as I'm concerned, if fetuses, and by the way, that's where most abortions occur, you know, in the first and early part of the second trimester, where no one is really arguing that that those fetuses are sentient. And if they aren't sentient, I don't have religious views about ensoulment. So, I mean, but the bottom line is, as far as I'm concerned, if the fetuses aren't sentient, I don't think they have any interest at all. But let's assume, I mean, you know, the interesting philosophical question is, well, what if fetuses are sentient? Or, you know, what about people who get abortions late in the gestation process where fetuses might be sentient? Again, I'm not conceding that they are sentient. I don't know whether they're sentient or not. But let's assume for argument purposes that at some point in time in the gestation process, fetuses are sentient. All right, fine. Is that a problem for me? Yes, I'm very concerned about that. If fetuses are sentient at any point in the gestation process, then I am concerned about that. However, I would say to you this. If you have a situation where you have sentient fetus, you have a fetus that's sentient, you've got this very weird situation which is replicated nowhere else in nature. Let's assume the fetus is sentient, and let's assume that the fetus is a right holder. You have got one right holder living inside the body of another right holder. You have only two choices. You either let the decision about that right holder be made by the primary right holder in whose body the secondary right holder exists, or you let that decision be made by some white male legislator or judge, you know, who isn't going to ever get pregnant anyway. And I'm not comfortable at all with that decision being made, particularly in a patriarchal, sexist society like this. I am very uncomfortable with that decision being made by anyone other than the primary right holder, that is, the woman in whose body the secondary right holder exists. And you can't analogize abortion, in my judgment, to a situation, I mean, you know, people say to me, well, what's the difference, you know, if the fetus is sentient, then why do you think that the woman should have the right to make that decision, whereas you think it's perfectly all right for us to stop the vivisector from using the animal in an experiment? And the answer is, to me, I mean, the distinction is clear to me. With vivisection, you've got two independent beings. You've got the animal and the vivisector. They are two independent beings. Can I intervene in that, you know, in the exploitation of the dog by the vivisector without interfering in the body of the vivisector? The answer is yes, of course, they are two separate beings. The only way I can regulate the relationship between the primary and the secondary right holder in the abortion context is for me to intervene and tell that woman she has to use her body in a particular way. And my view is simple. If there is a God, that decision is between that primary right holder and God. And I am very, very uncomfortable, given that I live, the world that I live in, is a world of patriarchy and sexism, I am very uncomfortable with anybody but the primary right holder making that decision. If I lived in a world, if I lived in a non-patriarchal, non-sexist world, I might feel differently about the regulation of that event. But I don't live in that world, and I'm not likely in the time I'm on the earth to live in that world. I mean, remember something. We are still in a world in which people are saying, are we ready for a woman as president? I mean, the idea that we are not sexist, the idea that we are not patriarchal, I mean, that's absurd. We're sitting around saying, are we ready for a woman? Are we ready for a black? Are we ready for a Hispanic? I mean, you know, and we don't even realize when we ask those questions that those questions are racist, those questions are sexist, those questions are patriarchal. We don't even realize that. And so I'm not likely at age 52 to ever live in a world that is not sexist. I don't even know what a world that's not sexist or patriarchal would look like, to be honest with you. But I'm not going to live in it. Whatever it looks like, I ain't going to get there. And so I don't feel comfortable with deciding that conflict of interest, which is, as I say, very peculiar, because you've got one right holder living inside the body of another right holder. I mean, that doesn't replicate itself anywhere in nature. All the other conflict situations we have are situations where there are independent, mean, you know, if you take a parent and a child, you know, a parent and a 5-year-old, and there's a question about whether or not the parent is abusing the 5-year-old, the state can step in, mm-hmm. intervene, and protect the interests of the child without intruding on the body of the parent in the way that the intrusion is necessary. I mean, the intrusion is qualitatively different when you're talking about abortion. You're saying that you are forcing that woman. Basically, I mean, it's a form, in my judgment, of enslavement. You are basically forcing her to use her body in particular ways. I don't feel comfortable doing that. But as I say, this is a short answer, and I understand it's probably not going to be satisfactory for some people. But go and read what I write about this in Introduction to Animal Rights and in Women and Animals, that book it's a book of readings. I didn't write the book. It's a book of it's an edited book. I believe Carol Adams edited the book, and I have an essay in there about this. But look. One thing, it's not that I don't regard abortion as a serious issue, particularly if fetuses are sentient. I don't know whether they are, but, you know, they may be, particularly, you know, later on in the gestation process. They may be. I don't know. But I certainly think it's a serious issue. One thing I do want to say is that I think this raises serious questions. Mm-hmm. And I want to emphasize, I think most women regard abortion as raising serious questions. The notion that women regard abortion as nothing more than birth control, or they look at it in as a trivial act or whatever, I believe is part of sexist mythology. I know a lot of women who have had abortions, and the women I know who have had abortions, and I know a lot of them, have thought about the issue very seriously. To me, the question is, who makes the decision between the primary and secondary right holder in a situation that is very, very that is unique and peculiar in our moral landscape?
Excellent. Another question that kind of deals with this conflict of
before rights. We go on to that, do you like agree? I mean, you know, do you think I'm on solid ground there, Bob and Jenna?
I believe you're absolutely on solid ground.
Completely.
I mean, we were talking about this right before we did the show. We took the dogs for a walk, and we were talking about the abortion issue, and we actually said, well, you know, there's really no way in which you could talk about the rights of a fetus as being separate from the rights of a mother. I mean, at least in the first two terms, you know, the first two trimesters.
Let me tell you something else. If men got pregnant, abortion would never be a problem.
I'm sure it wouldn't be.
I mean, it wouldn't be. We wouldn't be having this discussion if we had babies, Bob. It's only because women have babies.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh,
but no, we were also saying on our walk that I think the reason this question came up so much is that it is hard for a group of people who are so concerned about the welfare of others to just come up with, okay, well, we have the fetus, we have the mother, so how do I, you know, work that together into one theory? So I think people sometimes just have a hard time conceiving of what, you know, what do I think about this? If I agree that life is important in the life of others, but I think what you said about the two rights being in that one strange situation that we don't have anywhere else. It's just,
I can't think of another situation. I cannot think of another moral situation in which you've got a conflict that is of that sort. I mean, all other conflicts involve conflicts between two independent beings. And in most cases, particularly when we're talking about animals, we're talking about conflicts that are fabricated conflicts. I mean, we create the conflicts in the first place, but we create conflicts between humans and non-humans that are separate and independent actors and existers. But the abortion context raises a very, very, very weird sort of moral conflict situation. You've got one right holder living inside the body of a right holder. Okay, fine. Who decides how we're going to deal with the conflict? The woman in whose body the fetus resides, or, you know, some guy on Capitol Hill who ain't ever going to get pregnant in the first place? You know, and you know, or some judge who's never going to get pregnant in the first place in most cases. So I mean, who makes that decision? and you know, even if the judge happens to be a woman, it doesn't really matter, because the bottom line is we're in a patriarchal sexist situation.
Yep.
And I don't feel comfortable with the law making the decision as to who makes that, you know, as to how we decide the resolution of that conflict.
Well, let me ask you about another kind of conflict. I mean, completely different. I think it falls into the kind of conflict that you would probably find more clear-cut. But this is from someone on our forums named Snowboard Bunny. She asks how you feel about humans getting organ transplants from animals, or, you know, heart valve replacements from animals to save their own lives or the lives of a human. She says that she would reject such a transplant, but that she's had arguments with other people about it, and she's just wondering if she was crazy to say this. So what do you think of this idea?
Well, I mean, I don't think that we should be using animals in transplants any more than I think that we should be using marginalized humans in transplants. I mean, I empathize with is it Snowboard Bunny? Is that
Snowboard Bunny? Yes,
Snowboard Bunny. I empathize with her because I actually get this question a lot. And I don't know. I mean, someone once told me, and I don't know if this is true or not, but someone once told me that, apparently Jane Goodall, well, someone told me that Jane Goodall claimed that her mother got a pig valve heart transplant or something, and that she thought this was a great thing and whatnot. She was indebted to animals because her mother lived because some pig died or something. Now, I don't know if that's true. I mean, this is what I've been told when I've been asked this question in various fora in which I have been speaking, but I don't think it's morally justifiable. I don't think it's any more morally justifiable than the use of humans to save other humans. What I frequently am asked is, well, you know, what if it's necessary? I mean, this is a question I get all the time, and I'm not exactly sure what the thinking is, but I get this question. But what if it's necessary to save a human life, to kill an animal? If we can kill an animal and save a human life, if it's necessary to do so, isn't that justified? The answer is no. First of all, let me say this. I have an article coming out sometime this spring, I think, in Law, Medicine, and a journal called Law, Medicine, and Ethics, in which I examine the concept of the necessity of animal use in biomedical contexts. I mean, it's interesting to me that the only use of animals that we make, the only thing that we use animals for that is arguably necessary is for these sorts of purposes. Because, I mean, certainly the use of animals for food is not necessary. I mean, we eat animals because we like the taste. There is nobody who maintains that we need to be eating animals for human health. Indeed, it's probably killing us. But we don't need them for food. We don't need them for entertainment. We don't need them by definition. We don't need them for clothing. We don't need them for sport hunting. We don't need them for any purpose whatsoever. There is no plausible necessity claim except for one possible use, and that's the use of animals for biomedical purposes. And what I do in this article is I explore that the claim of necessity, even in this context, is really problematic. I mean, for example, given that we use animals for the development of every single procedure that we have, we aren't in a position to say that we would not develop those procedures or even better procedures if we didn't have animals to rely on. I mean, we don't have any control. There's no way to sort of tell whether or not we would have developed those things if we didn't have animals. So I sort of go through the first part of the article is basically a set of arguments about why the necessity claim is problematic. And then the second part of the article, I say, even if the animal use is necessary, it's not morally justifiable. But the bottom line is that, as far as you know, in response to Snowboard Bunny's question, did I get that right?
That's
yep,
right.
That's right.
Okay. In response to that person's questions, let's just refer to this person as Bunny. In response to Bunny's question, I don't see that question as any different from saying, well, is it all right for us to use poor people for transplants to help rich people, or to use dumb people to help for, you know, as transplants for, you know, for smart people? I mean, I don't see that question as really any different. And I think that what that person need, what Bunny needs to do when Bunny is asked that question, is Bunny needs to say, how is that any really, how is that any different from saying it's all right to sacrifice one person for another person? The fact that, you know, that the persons involved may be human persons or non-human persons is irrelevant.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And that sort of relates to the next question. We talked a little bit about this the last time you were on the show, but Tim asks, can you explain more about what a right is?
Tim and the question about rights. Well, I'm going to be blogging about this on Wednesday, because that the concept of what a right is, it's generated a lot of confusion. And I have a blog that I'm going to be putting up on Wednesday as soon as I finish writing it. I'm in the process of writing it. But the current title, I think, of the blog is A Clarification of Rights. And what I want to do in that blog is try to demystify the concept of rights. Look, a right is nothing more than the way a way of protecting an interest. We all have interests. Some interests are protected with rights, some are not. To say that I have a right is simply to say that a particular interest I have is protected in a particular way. What is that way? It means that interest is protected against being sacrificed or ignored, even if the consequences of ignoring it or sacrificing it would be good for other people. So to say that, well, I've got a right of free speech, what does that mean? Well, I've got an interest in free speech. I have an interest in expressing myself. I have an interest in participating in what some people call, stupidly in my view, but nevertheless call it, the marketplace of ideas. I have these interests. To say that I have a right of free speech is to say that my interest in expressing myself or my interest in participating in the marketplace of ideas is protected even if other people would benefit from my being silenced. And a right is simply a way of protecting an interest. There's nothing mystical about a right. I mean, a lot of people think that a right, that the concept of a right, is metaphysical. That's nonsense. It's a very logical, practical term. There are only two ways of protecting an interest, consequentially or non-consequentially. And when we protect an interest non-consequentially, we call that a right. And I submit that we need, you know, every moral system, and I would argue even utilitarian moral systems, which claim to reject rights altogether, protect certain interests against being sacrificed. For example, the right to equal consideration, or the interest in equal consideration, which is a fundamental interest in the utilitarian philosophy, even though the utilitarian philosophy rejects rights, the utilitarian philosophy holds very strongly to this notion of equal consideration. I would say that if the interest in equal consideration can be sacrificed for collective reasons, then that presents some serious problems for utilitarians. But in any event, all I can say is tune in. What's the date Wednesday, Bob? Do you have a calendar there?
Let me see. Give me a sec. I do. It's on the computer, but popping up right now. Waiting. Wednesday would be the 31st.
The 31st.
Okay. Of January.
When is this blog, when is this podcast going out?
Today or the 28th or 29th.
Whoops.
All right, very good. Well, then on the 31st, I encourage you all to come to, it's Gary Francione on Blogspot.com, or whatever my URL is.
We'll put a link to it.
For my blog, I'm sorry, I don't know.
We'll put
what
a link.
What is it? Does anybody, it's GaryFrancione.blogspot.com.
That's right.
You will see the answer to this penetrating question. But there's nothing mysterious about rights. And there are some people who are concerned about the foundation of rights and blah, blah, blah. But the bottom line is, a right is a very, it really is a, it's a concept of logic, not a concept of metaphysics, and I hope to explain that in a couple of pages, although it ain't easy, in my blog on Wednesday. So tune in on the 31st, and I will give you my answer on that.
Excellent. And from this one, we have James. James wants to know what you think of Joan Denayer's claim that your theory, especially your five conjunctive criteria in the chapter of Ring Without Thunder entitled Rights Theory, an Incremental Approach. What do you think of this idea that what you have to say is welfarist?
Well, I think that it's silly, and I think that if Denayer were being honest, she would admit it's silly as well. Let me preface my substantive response with some background that I hope will explain Denayer's comments. In January of 2004, Denayer wrote to me, and she told me that she had read Introduction to Animal Rights, and she thought it was a great book. And she asked me if I would write the foreword to Speciesism. Yes, it's odd but true. I still have the letter. She asked me to write the foreword. So I agreed to look at her book, and so she sent me the manuscript, and I still have that here, and you can look at it for yourself. It does not contain one word of criticism of my theory, not one. In fact, she said a great many nice things about my work. But the problem was that I couldn't really see how what she was saying was very original. The book was basically an elaboration of points I've been making for about 20 years now about the property status of animals and the distinction between rights and welfare and the problem with requiring human-like cognition for full membership in the moral community. The gap approach, which is being picked up by others such as Friends of Animals, who we talked about in one of the earlier questions. So I wrote Joan a foreword that basically said the truth, that she had made some interesting observations about various themes that I had developed, and I thought some of her observations were interesting, and that's what I said in the foreword. I did point out that she had certain views about the importance of law in regulating animal exploitation, and that I disagreed with her views on that issue, but that by and large her positions mirrored mine. Joan got very angry, and she proceeded to take out all of the favorable references to me and many of the citations to my work, and then she added a great many distortions and misrepresentations of my work. So it's all quite clear. All you have to do is compare the two copies of the book. It's unfortunately, in my judgment, a matter of intentional misrepresentation.
I mean, there's also the claim in there that that you use speciesist language, which I find really mind-boggling.
Well, yeah, I mean, Yes. I mean, it's interesting because, she on one hand claims that, Introduction to Animal Rights is a great book when she asked me to write the foreword, and then she comes back and says that she thinks that it's speciesist. I think that's silly. I mean, it's interesting. On the jacket of the book, she had some quotes from Professor David Nybert at Wittenberg University and Professor Michael Allen Fox from Queens in Canada and Steve Sapontis from Cal State. When the book came out, Nybert and Fox wrote to Denayer and told her they wanted her to take their endorsements off the book because of her misrepresentations of my views. And Sapontis asked her to modify his endorsement, and Denayer refused to honor their request. But anyway, with respect to the substance, I think, the idea that my views are speciesist is silly. I mean, she not only claims that the language is speciesist, which Jack, but she also claims that my theory is speciesist because she claims that I require more than sentience for full membership in the moral community. I mean, that is absolutely wrong. A central theme of my work for years has been that we shouldn't require anything more than subjective awareness for full membership in the moral community. If you're sentient, you have the right not to be treated as a resource. You have a right to equal consideration. And that has been a very clear and central point of my work for years. As to her claim that my work is welfarist, that's bizarre. I mean, for 20 years I have been attacked by the animal welfare movement because I am a relentless critic of animal welfare. Now Denayer claims that I'm a welfarist. My work is clear, Bob, and I think you know this. I think animal welfare is a dreadful failure, and animal welfare is structurally unsound. It requires that we balance the interests of humans who have rights, particularly property rights, against non-humans who have no rights and who are property. And I think that those who are serious about abolition ought to become vegans. They ought to engage in nonviolent abolitionist vegan education as a way of shifting the paradigm away from the property status of animals. And I have been very critical of pursuing legislation or regulation because I don't think it works. I don't think that we're ever going to see the law providing any significant protection to animal interests as long as we don't have a strong and significant abolitionist base that will support prohibitions that really do in significant and really significant ways move animals incrementally away from the property paradigm. So I've been very skeptical of regulation for a long time. I don't think it can work. I mean, and that's why I think if you look at animal welfare, what you see is a history of campaigns that simply fail. And what most animal welfare campaigns do is simply make animal exploitation more efficient. They make it more beneficial for the animal exploiters. It doesn't really do anything to move animals away from the property paradigm. Indeed, it makes the exploitation of animal property more efficient. And so now these are ideas are, you know, the things I've just described are ideas in, that show up in basically everything that I write, but they were a central focus of my 1996 book that you mentioned before, Rain Without Thunder, which was about why abolitionists should reject animal welfare altogether. Now, in Chapter 7 of that book, I say that if advocates want to pursue legislative or regulatory campaigns, they ought not to pursue the welfareist regulation that was being promoted in the 1990s and is still being promoted now, the free range this and the compassionate that they should at least try to make sure that the campaigns don't reinforce the property status of animals. That is, if they're going to pursue these campaigns, and I am very skeptical of them, I say that they should at least pursue those that represent an incremental eradication of property to the extent that they can, because this is consistent with the ultimate goal of abolition. And in this context, in Chapter 7 of Rain Without Thunder, I offer, in a very preliminary manner, five conjunctive conditions. And I say at the outset of the chapter, I say, look, you know, this is, I'm offering this analysis in a preliminary way to get the discussion going within the movement about why welfare doesn't work, and that if we're going to pursue legislative and regulatory campaigns that I'm skeptical about as a general matter, I think they at least ought to try to incrementally move away from property status. And I say that if you want to do that, the campaign should at least have the following characteristics, and I have five conjunctive, that is, they all have to be satisfied, five conjunctive characteristics. First, you have to have a prohibition. Secondly, the prohibition has to be of a significant institutional activity so that it's not just a minor prohibition, but it's a major prohibition. And I acknowledge these are imprecise terms. That the third characteristic be that the prohibition explicitly recognizes that animals have inherent value. The fourth condition is that the prohibition recognizes that that the animal interest to be protected can't be sacrificed for economic reasons, because then the interest will be sacrificed for economic reasons. And five, that the prohibition not in any way substitute a more humane form of the same practice, and that the prohibition, the campaign for the prohibition, be coupled with a clear call for the abolition of all animal exploitation. So I have some pretty heavy-duty conditions that a campaign would have to satisfy in order to represent, in my view, a sufficient departure from the property paradigm. Now, I also make it clear in Chapter 7 that I don't think a campaign that meets all these characteristics would have a snowball's chance in hell of succeeding, because animals are property, and that any campaign that was this clear about the rejection of property status, of the incremental rejection of property status, would not stand a very, very significant chance of succeeding in a society in which animals are property and the economic interests that people have in animals is significant. I also say that even if such a campaign would succeed, it would be imperfect, because it's not going to result in all animals being free from exploitation. It's not going to result in abolition. It will result in an incremental step towards abolition. It will result in an incremental step toward eradicating property status, but it will not be a perfect situation, because it will still leave a lot of animals you know, in the system of exploitation, because it's by definition an incremental step here. So, you know, the idea was simply to say, look, I'm skeptical of all these regulatory legislative campaigns. I think we just ought to focus on veganism, creative vegan abolition, you know, lawful boycotts, those sorts of grassroots activities, which will result in building a social and political movement that will support abolitionist steps later on. But that we don't have enough political and social support for abolition now, and that these legislative and regulatory campaigns are invariably going nowhere. The empirical proof is clear. And what I say is that if you want to pursue these things, at least pursue things that incrementally move away from property status. However, be aware, folks, that I don't think these things can work now, because even if they're, you know, any campaign that has these characteristics will probably be resisted mightily by the animal exploiters and the people who consume animals who will not want to, you know, not support these measures. And Denayer looks at Chapter 7, and she ignores the fact that the conditions have to be conjunctive, and you know, she ignores the skepticism that I have about these things, and she basically says, I'm advocating regulatory measures. Now, I'm not doing that. I'm saying, I don't like these things. If you want to pursue them, then you ought to pursue certain sorts of measures that move away from the property, or at least attempt to move away from the property paradigm. And interestingly, in the version of the book that she sent to me and to apparently to others to look at, none of this was, she understood this completely. I mean, she understood what I was saying completely. And then when I would not write the foreword she wanted, she proceeded to add all of this stuff that I was really in favor of regulation. And really, ironically, she says in her book, she's in favor of regulatory campaigns that fall short of abolition. And her analysis ends up being much less restrictive than mine. So she actually supports campaigns that would not satisfy the criteria that I articulated in Rain Without Thunder. But I want to tell you, I am not a welfarist, Bob. And by the way, Jeff Purs, who's a philosophy graduate student, has written an analysis of Denayer's work. It's at www.speciesismreview.info, and it's published in the Journal of Animal Law. And I think he's working on something else about Denayer's analysis of my work. But if you're interested, you should go to that website or to the Journal of Animal Law and see what Purs has written. It's unfortunate that Denayer's trying to confuse matters for her own purposes, but I'm pretty confident that anyone who's familiar with my work knows that she's both ripping off my ideas and then intentionally misrepresenting me. It's unfortunate, but wow. What are you going to do?
I have a quick question for you, though.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, keeping in line with talking about these regulatory campaigns, I'm wondering what you think of the recent gestation crate campaign. I think, where was it, in Florida?
Yes. Yeah, I wrote a blog on that on my website. It's called A Triumph, and triumph is in quotes, of animal welfare. I don't think much of it. I mean, there are a number of different reasons why I think that is a bad idea. I mean, first of all, if you look at that campaign is a very good example of the problems with traditional welfare campaigns. If you look at the literature of the people who are supporting the gestation crate ban, what they're basically arguing is that pork producers will make more money if they get rid of the gestation crate, because European studies show that pigs are healthier when they're raised in alternative situations. So right off the bat, you have the notion of efficient exploitation coming into play, with animal advocates saying, here is something that we can do that we think will improve the welfare of animals, but it will also make animal exploitation more efficient. And again, I think that's a rather weak position to be taking, you know, that we can make animal exploitation more efficient. We can improve your profits. We can make your pigs more profitable, if you'll just give them an alternative living situation, number one. Number two, the actual, in Florida, there were only two producers who were using the gestation crate, and they were basically going out of business anyway. So it was something that didn't affect anybody, and there was no opposition to it. And there were all sorts of it wasn't an absolute prohibition. It allowed pigs to be kept in confinement for particular purposes for particular periods. So it wasn't an absolute prohibition, and it didn't require that they be placed in group housing or in any sort of significantly different situation. It simply required that they be given more space so that they could turn around without touching the sides of the enclosure that they were in. So there were a number of problems with it, but it is, in my judgment, a very interesting illustration of my point that what animal welfare does is simply make animal exploitation more efficient. And so you end up with animal advocates being advisors to the meat industry saying, hey guys, you can make greater profits if you treat your animals a little bit nicer. And certainly, as I've always said, I'm always in favor of less suffering and not more. But I think it's a sad comment that the animal movement has been reduced to being economic advisors for the meat industry, or the animal exploitation industries. But I have a full analysis of this on my blog, which is GaryFrancione.blogspot.com, and it's called The Triumph of Animal Welfare, and it deals with the gestation crate campaign.
Actually, this is about Heifer International. A friend of mine, Eric, over at Animal Friendly Life, that's a kind of a news aggregation and blogging site where he talks about animal rights issues and things. He had a back and forth with Heifer International, and one of the users on our forums, Dandelion, wants to know what you think about Heifer International, which, you know, for those of you that don't know, I think you give them a donation and they provide usually a dairy cow or other kinds of livestock to peasants in third world countries. And what do you think of this?
Well, you know, the short answer is not much. I don't think we should be providing non-humans for humans to consume anywhere, whether in the third world, first world, 25th world, or whatever. I don't think we should be eating animals. Any of us should be. Indeed, I think animal agriculture represents one of the most offensive forms of elitism, and I don't think we should be exporting that elitism to anybody else. I think we should be stopping it ourselves and not exporting it to other people. So I don't think much of Heifer International. I mean, Dandelion also, I mean, if I remember that person's question, he or she said that person had given contributions to Oxfam only
yes.
for the use to buy plants and water.
Water and trees. That's right.
Right. Water and trees. Water and trees. And wanted to know if I knew whether Oxfam used the money for just water and trees. I mean, the answer is I don't know what Oxfam does, and
yeah.
I wouldn't want to be in a position of representing what they do or what they don't do. But remember, I mean, obviously, if you give money to Oxfam and they're going to, I mean, it's an organization that does provide livestock. So even if they use, you know, some money to provide trees and water, they're still providing livestock with other money. So I would stay away from those organizations. I think those organizations are more things which appeal to first, I hate this first world, third world business. I mean, but you know, they appeal to our mentality. Let's help those poor people,
yeah.
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're doing that with those sorts of efforts. I really don't, and I certainly don't think that we're doing any favor by providing non-human animals so that we can clog the arteries, give prostate and breast cancer and other forms of disease to people in the third world. I think we all ought to stop eating animals altogether, and I think that the agricultural economy would be healthier for everybody all over the planet, whether they are in the first, second, third, 10th, or 25th world. I think that things would be much better for us all if we stopped consuming animals.
Indeed. Definitely agree with that. All right. Let's see. We have another question from Texas Cat.
How am I doing on these? Are you happy with these answers?
Are you kidding? Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful.
Absolutely. I feel bad, though. I mean, you must be getting tired. These are long.
No. You don't understand, man. I'm a vegan. I'm a vegan. I have been a vegan for 24 years now.
Man.
I have energy. I have energy. You young people, go ahead. I mean, if you get tired, just let me know, but I'll keep going.
Okay. Excellent. Let's see. Well, Texas Cat Chick has a question about
How do you
about
pronounce
veganism.
That?
Texas Cat Chick.
Oh, okay. All right. I didn't know how to pronounce that at all. Okay.
She's from Texas, and she has cats. So there you go.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. She understands that the number one thing that we can all do to change the horrible situations that animals are in now is to be vegan. What kind of organized strategy do you see as being the most effective way to change the legal status of animals?
The problem I have with that question is legal status. I don't think that we're going to change the legal status of non-humans until we have a real moral and social shift in our thinking about non-humans. The law does not lead, Jenna, in changing social and moral values. The law reflects social and moral values. I mean, Karl Marx said that the legal super the law was part of the superstructure with the economics being the substructure. And I think that whatever else you think of Karl Marx, he was dead right on that. That the law follows, the law doesn't lead. Indeed, in my entire lifetime, I've been a lawyer now. I graduated, I hate to say this, in 1981 from law school. It is 25 years since I graduated from law school. I can't believe that. But in my lifetime, the only instance in which the law has been out front of social and more, you know, general social and moral thinking has been on the issue of abortion, and the right of choice has been significantly whittled down to the point of being non-existent, largely for that reason, because it was a legal rule that was imposed, I guess, for want of a better word, before the society had gotten to that point. The law is not a leader. The law is a follower. We are not going to change the legal status of animals are property. They have only extrinsic or conditional value. They do not have inherent value. Okay, that's important to understand. They only have the value that we give them. They have no value. They have no inherent or intrinsic value. They only have extrinsic or conditional value. That is not going to change until there is a critical mass of people who accepts the abolitionist point of view and who aren't eating them. And you know, eating their flesh, eating their milk, eating their whatever. I mean, you know, who aren't consuming them at all, aren't wearing them. The law is only going to change. You're only going to see the law providing significant protection for animal interests once there is a critical mass of us who are willing to, you know, who are in the process of shifting the paradigm. Right now, animals are property, and the law will reflect that paradigm. So until we move to the notion that animals are persons and not property, that's why I call the latest book I'm doing is, you know, the personhood of animals. I'm sorry, Columbia, I haven't gotten it to you yet, but at least I'm trying to push it here on Bob and Jenna's podcast. So I'm trying to do something good commercially for you. You know, as long as they're property, then the law is going to reflect their property status. It's only when we start thinking of them as non-human persons that the law is going to change, and we can't think of them as non-human persons as long as we're eating them. I mean, this is my fundamental disagreement with people like Steve Wise, for example, who thinks that the law, I mean, Steve Wise, and certainly to some degree Denayer thinks this as well, that they think that the law is going to be in the forefront of change. That's fantasy land. The law isn't going to be in the forefront of change. The only way we're going to deal with this is by changing people. We need a revolution, a nonviolent revolution of people's hearts. A nonviolent revolution of people's hearts. We need to get people to think. We need to get people to shift the paradigm from property to personhood. And you can't do that as long as you're eating them. That's the bottom line. Yeah, or as long as you're wearing them, as long as you're hunting them, whatever. I mean, we need to get an abolitionist base if we're ever going to shift that paradigm. So in response to
Texas Ketchik.
Whatever. Does
that help?
I don't think that the law is going, you know, we need to take a step back and say it's not going to be the law that's going to be in the lead here. It's going to be morality It's going to be a shift in our moral thinking, our social thinking. The law will follow that. The law is not going to lead that.
Well, along those same lines of kind of making a change out there and changing kind of the baseline or the kind of revolution in the heart, I think is how you put it. Aaron and Karen and a couple others also want to know whether there are any groups that you regard as abolitionists that are doing really good animal rights work today.
Well, as far as I have to confine my comments to the United States because I don't really know enough about the large organizations in other countries. But as far as the national organizations in the United States are concerned, for the most part, no. I mean, there are a lot of organizations. They come and they go. I may not be aware of all of them. But with respect to the large national organizations, I don't think that there's any national group in the United States that is doing really good abolitionist work. Some people have asked me whether Friends of Animals is abolitionist because I did some work with them a few years back, and some people associate me with them.
Mm-hmm.
The answer to that is unfortunately no. I don't regard FOA as an abolitionist organization. I think they certainly have a good position on veganism, and I agree with their position on sexism. But many of the other positions that FOA has, I find problematic. For example, I have problems with their Alaska boycott. It suggests that there's a significant or meaningful difference between aerial shooting wolves from the air, aerial shooting of wolves, and non-aerial shooting or killing of wolves. I think that's problematic. I think a number of their campaigns are focused on the Endangered Species Act and CITES, and as I've discussed often in my writing, I think that the Endangered Species Act, CITES, and other environmental statutes have absolutely nothing to do with animal rights.
Mm-hmm.
FOA has a fur campaign, focuses on fur, and maybe I'm missing something here, but I don't see any references in their campaigns to wool and leather and silk, et cetera. And you really can't distinguish those other types of clothing. The campaign suggests, I mean, their campaign, their anti-fur campaign suggests that some animal clothing is better than other animal clothing, and I guess it reflects that some animals are better than other animals approach that they've embraced with their endorsement of this grade A standing and personhood campaign. And I just disagree with that. And indeed, some years ago, FOA asked me to speak at their Fur Free Friday, and I accepted on the condition that the first thing I would say when I got up to give that keynote speech was that I had a problem with the idea of Fur Free Friday, and that I thought it should be called Animal Clothing Free Friday, because I don't really see a distinction, and I think this is the sort of thing I was talking about earlier. I mean, I really think we've got to be clear when we have these campaigns. You know, if you're going to focus on fur, you can, you know, at least say yeah, but you know, fur is not good, but neither are all these other forms of animal clothing. And so I have a problem with these campaigns that just focus on fur. I mean, FOA is really a new welfarist group. I mean, I did work with them a few years ago. I tried to influence them to go in a different direction, and I failed. I mean, are they better than PETA? Yes, they're better than PETA, but, you know, just about any organization is better than PETA. I mean, I think PETA is doing an enormous amount of harm to the cause of animal rights, more so than any single organization. They're confusing people. I mean,
sure.
When you're giving awards to slaughterhouse designer like Temple Grandin, or
yeah,
telling us that you know, the only good animal is a dead one, and we ought to kill every animal we get our hands on, and you're constantly using sexist imagery, I mean, I think what PETA's doing is very harmful. So, you know, is Friends of Animals a better organization than PETA? You know, the answer is yes, but, you know, so is the Humane Society of the United States.
Well, but I mean, the other thing with FOA is that they're on record opposing things like you know, the compassionate standards that John Mackey has proposed.
Oh yeah, no. I like their position on veganism.
Sure.
So that's, I mean, I think that's great. I think that their position on veganism is clear, at least what I've seen. I think their position on sexism is very good, because they've taken a position on sexism that I think is good. They've taken a position on violence. I think that's good. Although they have had campaigns, you know, a few years back, they were arming, you know, game wardens or they were providing some sorts of, I think they were providing arms to game wardens in Africa, but they had some campaign involving what I regarded at the time as promoting violence on the part of people who were acting as game wardens in Africa. But they have said things about violence that I think are good, even if some of their campaigns have, in my judgment, promoted violence. They definitely have some positions I like. But on the other hand, many of their campaigns are classical new welfarist campaigns, particularly their environmental campaigns. They've got a number of new welfarist campaigns, and I don't regard them as an abolitionist organization. As I say, I think they're better than PETA, but you'd have to look. I'm not sure that's saying a great deal. There are, and let me say something before I go on. I used to work very closely with PETA, so my observations about PETA are not abstract in any sense. They're quite personal in the sense that I worked very, very closely with PETA throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s. I worked very closely with Ingrid Newkirk and Alex Pacheco and watched PETA go from what was in the early 80s a very interesting organization, an organization that I thought was really going to change how we thought about the issue, and watched it drift into embracing increasingly welfarist positions, what actually caused the rupture and what caused me to stop working with them was in the early 1990s they started with the sexism campaign. You know, I'd rather go naked than wear fur, and then there was that event at their Aspen Hill sanctuary, in which they killed a number of healthy animals, and when this was discovered, and I did not know that. I found out about it when everyone else did, and I thought it was horrifying. So what's been going on recently with them, with respect to the killing of healthy animals and the position on no kills and the position on trap, neuter, return, etc. This has been a long-standing problem with PETA. But in any event, I do think in many ways that PETA is doing a great deal of harm to the cause of animal rights and is creating an enormous amount of confusion. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time that we all just move beyond PETA. But there is good news on the horizon, though. I don't want to be negative. There's good news on the horizon. There are all sorts of really fine efforts to support. There are people all over the place doing great work. We don't hear about them because they don't have the budgets for relentless self-promotion that these other groups have. But I recently blogged about a group called the Animal Spirit, which is the group of someone named Shel Sullivan, who is a one-person trap, neuter, return education source. I mean, she's doing terrific work educating people all over the world about trap, neuter, return, as well as being involved in her own TNR activities. She's a very strict vegan. She talks about veganism and about reducing the population of domesticated non-humans. And she's doing good education, but she's also doing on-hands work, doing a terrific job. And she's doing it basically. She's not part of any large organization, and she's doing it basically with some colleagues who are like-minded. I talked about Eileen Chamberlain, who is really the last chance for the adoption of hundreds of animals every year. I mean, this is somebody who works with a kill shelter. She's a volunteer. She doesn't get paid. She's a volunteer for a kill shelter, and what she does is she takes animals out of the shelter who are at risk, and she takes them to places to try to get them adopted. We have several of our dogs are dogs that we've got. I mean, we have a blind dog that we got from her that was going to be killed. We have a dog. We have several. We have dogs that have some behavioral problems that we took that were going to be killed at the shelter that we got from Eileen. And she really is the last chance for for hundreds of animals every year. And I think that is, I mean, you know, again, she's a vegan. She talks to people when she's at the adoption places. She's talking to people about abolition and veganism and whatnot. But she's also, you know, rather than lamenting the fact that we're killing all these animals in shelters every year, which is certainly a lamentable fact, she's doing something about it. And that's, and I think that's terrific work. And there are also people who are doing really good vegan abolitionist educational work, for example. And they're all over the place. We just don't hear about them because they're not, they're organizations that are critical of the large national organizations in the United States, so you never hear about them because they are not promoted by these organizations. The only organizations that these groups promote are organizations that are, you know, basically like-minded. And so you don't ever hear about these people. But there's a group in Argentina called ANIMA, A-N-I-M-A. Their website is, I wrote it down before, and let me see if I can find it in this mess called my desk. www.anima.org.ar. AR, standing for Argentina, not animal rights, Argentina. And that is... That is a group headed by someone named Anna Maria Aboglio, who is a lawyer, but she's also trained in philosophy. She's a very, very bright, energetic person, and she does an excellent job educating people about abolition and veganism in Argentina and in you know, in that part of the world generally. I mean, she's getting her work out to people in neighboring countries. I mean, she's really doing a very, very good job. When I was in Spain last May, I met a number of people who were dedicated to basic grassroots vegan abolitionist education. For example, I mean, I was in Spain giving lectures on animal rights, on abolition. I mean, we weren't talking about animal welfare. We were talking about abolition and about vegan theory at the University of Valencia, at Murcia, University of Murcia, and at Carlos Tres University in Madrid. Uh-huh. I met a number of people. Number of people who were involved in grassroots abolitionist education. For example, I met some folks in Valencia. Their group was called, I wrote that down, Defense, D-E-F-E-N-S-A-N-I-M-A-L, Defense dot, defenseanimal.org. They had a booth every Sunday at the local community center, and they distributed literature about abolition and veganism and the relationship between speciesism and sexism and racism and anti-Semitism and homophobia. They're politically progressive, they're vegan, they're abolitionist, they're nonviolent. There was another group that I found, actually as a result of the last show that I did with you in November, which I guess was the first show. It was the last show and the first show that I did with you in November. Someone wrote to me about a group called Peaceful Prairie. Mm-hmm. And I started looking into them, and they're at www.peacefulprairie.org. And I haven't had the pleasure of meeting them personally yet. I intend to, but I haven't done so yet. But everything that I've learned about them so far impresses me a great deal. I mean, first of all, they actually call themselves an abolitionist sanctuary. I mean, that in and of itself says something.
That's cool.
They do great education work. Their website is chock full of great vegan information. They're very, very clear about rejecting free range, compassionate consumption, all the whole foods mythology. I mean, they are very, very upfront about rejecting that. They actually have a Go Vegan billboard by the Denver Livestock Market, which takes some guts to do, actually, and I mean, they're doing vegan education, and they're in really clear, unequivocal vegan education, and they're also caring for about 300 farm animal refugees. I mean, you know, so that that's a lot of work, and so I'm very, very excited about them, and I intend as soon as the snow goes, both here and in Colorado, because they're having a horrible winter out there, I intend to go out there and visit them, because I think this is a very, very interesting concept. And these folks have been going for a few years, and it's interesting. I haven't heard anything about them from the national organizations. I find it really very, very interesting that if you're not marching with the you know, if you're not marching with the movement, if you're not sort of in the mainstream promoting the welfarist and new welfarist positions, you aren't getting coverage from these other organizations. And let us not forget, last but certainly not least, the individual. It is extremely important. We must all understand something. Veganism is the most important form of direct action or activism or whatever you want to call it. I mean, we cannot underestimate the importance of the decision of the individual to go vegan. That is extraordinarily important. It is not just a matter of diet. It is the application of the principle of abolition to the life of the individual. It is extraordinarily important. It is, as I say, the most important form of direct action or animal activism or whatever you want to call it, is your decision to become a vegan. And the individual can do a great deal, not only by herself becoming a vegan, but by engaging in creative vegan abolitionist education, which can take myriad forms. It can be leafleting at a mall or at some place where there are a lot of people. It can be putting up a Go Vegan billboard by the Denver Livestock Exchange, but it can also be something like, you know, simply writing letters to local restaurants about getting them to give, you know, to offer vegan options for people and educating people that way by saying you need to be having vegan options, which not only educates the restaurant owners, but it educates the people who are going to the restaurant who are now seeing vegan options and asking, what's that mean? What's that about? You know, that's a way of educating people. It's all activism. Or campaigning to get, you know, to get vegan foods in local food stores so that people, when they go to a supermarket, they're seeing vegan foods and more vegan foods. You know, that's a good thing. And so, you know, it's important to try to I mean, you know, that doesn't mean you then, you know, because a store is selling vegan foods, doesn't mean you start promoting the store the way that, you know, I mean, yes, Whole Foods sells some vegan foods. That doesn't mean you should be promoting Whole Foods as an institution. Sure. I think it's great that Whole Foods sells vegan foods. I wish they sold a lot more. Indeed, I wish they sold nothing but vegan foods. But, you know, I think it's important to try to get more vegan foods in stores, get more vegan options in restaurants, educate people about veganism, educate them about the fact that, you know, what they're eating and what it means, you know, in terms of the what it means to the animals and what it means for all of us by, you know, because we are all sort of actively involved in this violence every day. And so I think that, you know, we can't forget what the individual can do. The individual is extremely important, and the individual has a great deal of ability to change things. And unfortunately, we've gotten to a point where many of us think that doing something for the animals means sitting down and writing a check to one of the national organizations. And if you're a national organization, that's great that people think that. But as far as the cause is concerned, that's death. When you get a social movement where people think that the best thing that they can do is sit down and give money to somebody else, then you've lost.
That's
and
exactly.
I think that the national organizations, Bob, are a waste of time. In my judgment, they're a waste of time. The problem has never been, it's not now, and it's never been a lack of money. These organizations have tons of money. They have tons of money. And indeed, what goes on with a lot of these groups, not all of them, but with a lot of these groups, is scandalous. I mean, many of these groups, many of the people who run these organizations have large incomes. They have relatives on the payroll. They have, you know, expense accounts that pay for their travel and for their meals and for their, you know, automobile. I mean, it's a scandal. Dollar for dollar, I think the return with these large organizations is horrible. And I personally regard giving contributions to large national organizations as an enormous waste of time. Again, I'm only talking personally, but my, you know, as far as my giving is concerned, I give to local groups. You know, I support grassroots educational work. I support local hands-on work. I'm fascinated by this Peaceful Prairie organization. I would love to see more organizations like that. Those are the sorts of things that I think that we should be supporting. As far as I'm concerned, the national organizations are a waste of time. I think, by the way, what you and Jen are doing is terrific too, because you are reaching you're reaching many, many people, and you're really getting. I think you're resonating very well with your audience.
Well, thank
you. And just from what I'm seeing, you know, what I've seen when I visit your various forums and I see what's going on, you're obviously stimulating an enormous amount of discussion, which is what you want to do. I mean, you know, this is what we want to do. We want to get people talking. There isn't enough discussion in this movement. We don't discuss political ideology. We don't discuss the economic ramifications. We don't discuss, there's no discussion. There's no discussion permitted because it's really not a movement. It's much more of a cult. And so there really isn't a lot of discussion that's permitted. And what people like you and Jen are doing is facilitating that by stimulating that discussion and then providing a place where folks can gather and talk about these things. So I think I think dollar for dollar, what you're doing is much more cost effective than what these national organizations are doing.
That's very flattering.
True. It has the virtue of being true.
I appreciate that. What you're saying is kind of funny because just yesterday I was doing some research for the book I'm working on now, and I ended up on PETA's website because I was looking up their proggies from 2005.
Yeah.
Critiquing when they gave Pat Buchanan a proggy in 2005, which is something I just can't wrap my head around. But in any case, I ended up on one of their pages where it said, "Do you want to do something for animals right now?" And it just had this link, and it said, "Join PETA." And, you know, you click it, and it's just this form where you can enter your credit card, and you join PETA. And what does that mean? It means you're giving them cash. It doesn't mean a whole lot else.
And well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about, the Pat Buchanan issue. I mean, a related matter, and I agree with you absolutely, completely, but a related matter is, you know, you have a speechwriter for George Bush writing a book called Dominion.
Yeah.
A plea for mercy or whatever the subtitle was, but basically, an analysis of the situation, which was about as progressive as St. Thomas Aquinas writing in the 13th century. I mean, it's a very reactionary book based on religious values, and it reflects a very, very reactionary political ideology, and it was relentlessly promoted by PETA and virtually all the other organizations in the country, and that's really shocking. On my website on www.animal-law.org, we have a "What You Can Do" button, and we intend. I mean, you know, and when you press that, what it says is "Go vegan." You know, and because that's real. I mean, you know, I agree with you when you tell people you want to do something, join PETA. Then they think they're doing something by writing that check out.
Right.
And the bottom line is we've got to change that thinking. And although some people may think it's too direct, when someone comes up to me and says, "What can I do to help animals?" And I say, "Are you vegan?" And they say, "No." And I say, "Well, when you get serious, come back and talk to me, and we can have a discussion about it. Well, why can't I care about animals and still eat animals?" And I say, "Because think about the question you've just asked me. You know, how can you really be serious about that? You know, can I be really serious about this issue while I continue to eat them?" And the answer is no.
There's just no
and
way.
So, I think we really need to focus people on what they can do as individuals with the most important form of animal activism being your individual veganism. I would love to see everybody spending time every day doing something for animals in terms of vegan education or taking care of individual animals or, you know, whatever. But if you tell me you're a vegan and you have no time to do anything else, I say, great. Because, you know, by that one thing that you've done, in my judgment, that's the most important single thing you can do. Everything else is icing on the vegan cake.
I completely agree. And I think one of the nice things about veganism is that if you live well in the world as a vegan, if you live as a person who seems not kind of upset about the veganism, but content with veganism, you're confident in your veganism, I think that sends a message to people and it creates this little moment of cognitive dissonance for them. It's like, well, this person's a vegan. What is that about? And what does that mean? And that gives you a chance, I think, to educate people and to get them to think about what they're doing. And I think that living well as a vegan is you know, great advertisement.
You know, I always point out to my students, I'm you know, twice as old as most of them, and I have more energy than most of them. And you know, and I didn't do this. I did not do this for health reasons. I mean, I've been a vegan for, I guess, 24 years.
Welcome to vegan.
And I did not do this for health reasons. But I have to say, the benefits are absolutely remarkable. I do not feel like a 52-year-old person. I have an enormous amount of energy. I feel great. I never get ill. And I'll probably heart attack tomorrow or something. But no, I mean, it really is. It's a great way to live. And I also think, you know, one of the things that I'm troubled by, Bob, with this whole focus on the, you know, the conscientious omnivore and Whole Foods, et cetera, and the confusion that the welfarist movement has introduced is, you know, I had a student come up to me at school yesterday and started the conversation by saying, I'm a vegetarian. And I said, not a vegan. And she said, no, vegetarian. And I said, why not? Why not a vegan? And we talked for a few minutes, and it was very clear to me that she obviously cares about the issue, and I think we started a discussion that I hope will move her in the direction of becoming a vegan. But it's very clear to me that a lot of folks really, I mean, the movement isn't forcing them to think about veganism, because the movement is saying you can be a moral person by continuing to eat animal products, as long as you do so conscientiously and you cut out some of them. You can be a moral person in that way. And I mean, think about that as a matter of psychology. If you tell people you can be moral by being something less than a vegan, what's going to happen? People will not be vegans. I mean, you know, that's just logical. I mean, that's just common sense. If you tell them you can act morally by doing less than X, they will do less than X.
Absolutely.
And that's just normal, the way, you know, and it's disturbing and confusing when you have these large organizations that are promoting Whole Foods and giving awards to Temple Grandin and talking about what a great guy John Mackey is, and they're talking about, you know, how I mean, there was one quote from a PETA person about McDonald's, that McDonald's is I don't remember the exact words I quoted in an article that I have coming up, but a paraphrase is leading some animals are better animal welfare. I don't know, something like that.
It's absurd.
But when you have PETA praising these fast food restaurants, what sort of confusion does that convey? And the answer is a great deal of confusion.
I can't agree. I mean, I can't agree more. I just, one more thing I want to add, and I don't mean to keep you on this question, but some people have written to us and said, you know, you expect too much out of people. And what we do on our show, what we do and everything we do is about promoting veganism, because I think I agree with you that is one of the most direct steps to getting to where we want to be. And I think as a residual of what's going on in the movement right now, people think that we are demanding too much or asking too much of people. But I'm convinced that it's not asking too much of people, because I get emails from people often, you know, a couple a week, that say to me, you know, I am a vegetarian, I was listening to your show, and now I'm convinced I need to go vegan. Or I was an omnivore, and I was listening to your show out of curiosity, because I thought maybe vegans were full of shit, and I wanted to know what you were about. And now, you know what, you got me thinking, I want to be a vegan. And I'm going vegan, you know, next week, or I'm going vegan today. And for those reasons, I don't think we're expecting too much of people. And I think, like you said, that's the danger of welfarism, is that it allows for that kind of notion to exist. I mean, I think it
a distinction
out there.
Well, you know, look, think about it this way. If, I mean, I assume that you are opposed to pedophilia and other forms of child abuse. And if someone came up to you and said, you know, Bob, you're being a little too absolutist about this. And, you know, you really are an absolutist when it comes to child abuse, aren't you? You would say, well, of course I'm an absolutist when it comes to child abuse. And you know, we can think about various horrible things, whether it's, you know, child abuse or rape or torturing people, whatever the evil is. There are many things about which most of us have no trouble accepting those things are absolutely wrong and being absolutely opposed to them. And anybody, you know, if somebody said, you know, I'm really opposed to rape, and I think that rape is a really bad thing, and if somebody said to them, well, you know, gee, don't you think you're asking a bit much of people? I mean, don't you think that, you know, you can't really sort of expect too much of people? Most of us would be horrified by that sort of response. But when it comes to animal exploitation, I actually, when I was on your show in November, one of the responses I got from several people was that they didn't, you know, they thought that it was a bad idea. They thought that it was, you know, because I talk about the property status of animals as similar to human slavery, which it is. I mean, certainly as an institution, it functions in almost identical ways. It's not to say it's the same thing, because
there's
all
no
forms
question
of exploitation have differences, but certainly human slavery and the status of animals as property are very closely related. And I also used the rape example. You know, I said that you know, when I was asked, well, isn't it better for us to eat free-range animals than to eat non-free-range animals? And my response was, well, look, you know, if you're going to rape somebody, it's better not to beat the person, but not beating the person and just raping the person doesn't mean you're a conscientious or morally acceptable rapist. You know, that it's always better to do less harm than do more harm, but that doesn't mean doing less harm is morally acceptable. And several people responded to that by saying, well, you know, I think it's a bad idea to talk about human slavery. I think it's a bad idea to talk about rape. Now, I'm the first person to say I don't like to rank evils. I think that's a bad idea. But I also think that the bottom line is, for many people, many animal people, they still see a real huge difference between human exploitation and animal exploitation.
That's right.
And that makes them comfortable about saying something like, "Well, don't you think you're demanding too much of people? If you ask somebody to stop exploiting animals altogether, don't you think you're demanding too much from them?" When if we were to say, "I'm opposed to some form of human exploitation," and someone were to say, "Well, don't you think you're demanding too much of people by you know rejecting that form of you know, by asking them to reject that form of exploitation?" That observation would be regarded as horrible, and yet we don't see it as problematic when it is raised in the animal context. So I think that, you know, I don't think we're asking too much of people. I mean, the bottom line is, I think that one of the major problems of the movement in 2007 is that the movement itself is portraying veganism as an extreme thing, and I regard that as one of the most serious failings of the movement. The fact that in order to be economically acceptable, in order to keep those dollars rolling in, most of those organizations, and as you pointed out before, I mean, to FOA's credit, FOA's taking a vegan position, and I agree with that. I agree with any organization that is taking an unequivocal position on veganism and is rejecting the you know, the conscientious omnivore nonsense. I agree with any organization that is taking that position, but I think that, you know, it's terrible that that many of these large organizations are themselves promoting this idea that, you know, if you rape somebody and don't beat them, then, you know, you're a morally conscientious rapist. I think that's morally monstrous with respect to rape and with respect to animal exploitation.
So that was part one of our two-part interview with Gary Francione. We'll be rolling part two of that interview next week. Make sure you check in. We'll have that out on Saturday or Sunday, most likely. And that's about it. I hope that he's answering some of the questions you have out there. We gave him almost everything, let him pick and choose. And I think most of the questions will get answered, if not this week, certainly next. Remember, you can send us email at podcast@veganfreak.com. You can call our voicemail line at 267-295-1944. It should be on my refrigerator. I don't know why I can't remember that. In any case, be in touch. Make sure you drop by the forums if you want to check out the podcast thread about Francione, or send us an email, be in touch, and that's about it. Hope you have a good week. And, oh, don't forget, also, February is starting, so go vote for us over at Podcast Alley. As we raise up in the rankings there, it does good things for the show, and we hope does good things for veganism, so go vote for us. Thanks, and talk to you later. Bye. Your brain.
your freaks. Is that what you call your people who are?
Yeah.
Is that the right noun for the people who are adherents or who are subscribers?